This is Mark Mulcaster from FanfarTracks, and you are listening to the Rebel Base Card Podcast. Great pull, kid.
Did you think your dad was the only Mandalorian?
You've seen the show, and like us, you have questions.
Ooh, that was a good one, but try this one on for size.
No question should be left off your list.
Whoa, 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 I got a crazy theory, but hear me out.
But you better have some spares.
Oh, that was one of mine. All right, let's do this instead.
With me, as always, is my friend and Card Squadron winger.
This is Greg Cass, a.k.a. Ion Cannon.
We've recorded at home and across the U.S.
Last summer, we were from the Boston Common. This week, we're in Chicago.
This is day three of celebration.
The show has had many names, but the purpose is the same. Let's share some time at the table.
Ding, ding, it's time for breakfast.
Welcome to the Breakfast Pack, a Rebel Base Card micro podcast series. A returning Star Wars insert podcast series that asks more questions than it answers. Today on Breakfast Pack number 51, we are asking questions on Mandalorian Season 3, Chapter 19, The Convert, and Bad Batch Season 2, Episode 13, Pabu, which both premiered on Disney Plus on Wednesday, March 15th. Along with me, Greg McLaughlin, is my co-host and fellow Card Squadron winger Gregory Cass from Ion Cannon and Instagram and Hive. Greg, I am going to start this intro off with a question. Do you still find your current podcast situation comfortable? You got the reference.
Of course I do. But I'm always just worried about the mutually assured destruction. If I pull out of our arrangement, you're definitely going to sell me out to the imps who have been hunting me. So,
and all I've got to say is, so thank you for taking part in the podcast amnesty program. All right. This is an insert podcast series in the regular feed where Greg and I are going to trade questions to each other that we haven't talked about before because we've been too busy trying to catch up with all the shows. Then there's, of course, a chance we could take one another's questions. Now, since we're talking about a current series of Star Wars, if you haven't seen the episodes in question because you're too busy taking care of your Oscar hangover, this is a warning that there will be spoilers for these shows. If you haven't watched yet, we invite you to please come back and listen after you've watched. For this contest of questions, there are no points, bonuses, or lightning rounds, but there is the Greg's List, which is a selection of podcasts and other assorted media we ingested between shows to see if they have answered any of our questions and then some. It's also one of my favorite parts of the show as it highlights just some of the amazing work being done out there in the community. We hope you check out some or all and maybe find a new content creator you would like and support. Greg, anything on your Greg's List this week?
Yeah, there's so much good work being done. I feel like everybody's trying to balance out the two shows, and so that has led to some kind of people waiting and doing combined episodes. Oh, let's do two episodes of Bad Batch together. I know, for example, Blast Points this week pointed out that this Bad Batch and the next one are kind of a two-parter, so they said we'll hang back and talk to you next week. But I wanted to shout out Sky Talkers, which did a combined episode on 1 and 2 in the Mando season, and that was really quite good. They, of course, were still high on the conversation they'd had with Dave Filoni as a part of the junket. And they were at the premiere as well. So, another, like Dan Z, some creators who are getting these fantastic opportunities, but not letting it go to their heads, kind of staying humble and thanking their fans and knowing that that's the only reason they get that special attention. I will also shout out Podcast Stardust, which again, just cranking away at the content. Always a good listen. And I would just credit them with my favorite kind of positivity, which is, hey, we like it all and we want to celebrate it, but let's not go over the top and let's, be critical when we need to be critical and think carefully about things. And I just enjoy that because, again, so many people say, oh, we have to love everything and you can't speak ill about it. And my last one is actually, I plugged Ringerverse last week, which I want to plug again. They did, I think, 2 hours and 40 minutes on episode 2 of Mando. And somewhere deep in there, they had an email from a rabbi who talked about the connections between Judaism and the story of the Mandalorians as it is unfolding. And I hadn't realized this, but apparently it's well known that Jon Favreau is a practicing member of the Jewish faith, and had even suspended Iron Man production to have a Seder at a moment when they really couldn't afford to suspend production. So they were talking through what that influence might be and how the ways in which the Jewish people view the destruction of the temple is very similar to some of what we're hearing about Mandalore. And I'm not an expert on the Jewish faith, but I believe there were two temples. And after the two got destroyed, it was decided that redemption should be sought in the community. So you no longer had to go perform the baptism at the temple to be redeemed. You could do it in the synagogues and temples around the world. And just the kind of neat resonance that that might be where we are with Bo-Katan and with Din. Like, maybe Mandalore needs to move away from the planet. So it was fascinating, and you know, something I always love when somebody else's spirituality and faith can teach me a thing or two, because I don't know about it. And so it was really wonderful. So recommend all of those, plus the usual. And this one's a bone to pick.
He's wagging his finger. The finger's up.
Kent Jokjai, our dear friend, was on Coffee with Kenobi, and this is not Jen's fault, but she referenced our conversation and how I was suspicious of Bo after the first episode. And Dan Z went on to rebut my position using the second episode. And I'm sitting at home going, hey, wait, I didn't have that evidence. So that's not fair. Like, I went off of episode one, had a cool theory. I agree. I still, you know, I think episode two kind of changed the idea that maybe Bo was playing possum. But I'm like, you can't do that. I didn't have that episode. So all in good fun. I'm obviously just joking. But they had a great conversation with Corey, Dan, and Jen. And it was always just, you know, flattering to be mentioned in a conversation over there that they're listening and taking our ideas seriously. So I did appreciate it.
Oh, no. I mean, I was listening to the same episode. And whenever you're like, hey, you get a shout out in any episode, it's great. And that's why I love giving other people shout outs, because it just kind of makes your day. And it's fun to, you know, we are all listening to each other's podcasts and so forth. But I always kind of like it, you know, because when somebody mentions Greg, I'm like, hey, there's a 50% shot. They're talking about me, which they weren't. But still, it's like, yay. So I can kind of live vicariously through your name as well. But anyway, no. And you know, shout out to, you know, Jen and yourself and Antonia for getting through all that Oscar writing. I mean, I feel so bad, you know, because I was like, I know she was pumping out stuff. And of course, you know, when I'm, you know, wagging my finger as well, you know, the sad part is that, you know, I don't, in trying not to be super critical, right, because I don't want to bite the hand that feeds me, but I'm like, I still, there was no reason that they couldn't have waited and separated these two, because, you know, now you're seeing, especially in Batch, and even, you know, even in Mandalorian, you're seeing a lot of the subtlety that, you know, we're struggling to kind of get through it, and we're watching on our mobile phones, you know, I'm like bouncing in and out of it. And, you know, normally I would like to kind of watch it on the big screen, because you want to take advantage of all the great, you know, cinematography that was especially in Mando, and all the great animation that's happening in Batch. But, you know, it's just, you're going through it. And of course, you know, I'm feeling bad, because I'm sure that, you know, Colby has his, you know, both kids, you know, trapped in a basement, you know, chained up, you know, going down, and they're just like, and he's back there going, it'll put the microphone in the basket. And you're just like, you know, I'm feeling bad for his kids. You know, I know Jen's just like cranking out. And of course we had The Last of Us, you know, series finale, which I was kind of mostly in, because I know my son was watching it, and I would say it was amazing. So it's like, there's so much going on right now. And of course, you know, with HBO, that's one thing. But with Disney Plus, I think they have all the kind of controls on it. And of course, this is all before, you know, who knows what happens if they put the brakes on. You know, we're all going to be like, you know, the Halcyon days when we had things overlap. And, you know, are we going to go back to a more controlled spigot? So I do think that there is some tweaking that could be done. And I don't want to, like, shortchange. It's kind of sad, because you kind of shortchange, especially because Bad Batch is so done in the Clone Wars style, with the number of episodes, with, you know, the pacing of the show, and where it is right now in relationship to what Mando's doing. And it's just kind of the same thing. You're like, right in the middle of, you know, Mando, you're thinking, I've got this hour-long episode, and all of a sudden, you know, like, it's almost like something out of a Reese's, you know, peanut butter cup commercial, where it's like, hey, you got your Pershing, my Mando. Hey, you got your Mando and my Pershing. And you're, it's not until the second time where you can kind of go, oh, okay. All right. You know, you're kind of going through, and, you know, those of us who are a little older, it takes a little more for the brain to start firing. I'm going, at any rate, sorry to kind of channel the Tim Allen there, but that's the only way I can kind of do it. But at any rate.
Well, you're completely right. And, you know, we're talking in the afternoon where I believe this morning, or maybe it was yesterday already, Willow got the axe, and everybody was informed that won't get a second or continuing series. And that show, the way it ended, was clearly built for another season. And I would say, you know, it looked expensive, and it maybe was just too much of a stretch to try to revive that property. All of that being said, but it also started in the middle of Andor, and then, you know, kind of got overwhelmed with Bad Batch. I know quite a few shows kind of stopped covering it to cover Bad Batch. And so, you know, I think Lucasfilm has to be thinking about, like, well, how much are we spending on these things, and will they just get lost in the shuffle? So to your point, my other thinking is we don't have any firm dates for anything after Mando. So what was the rush to get Mando here and get it out? You know, I might be tied to Celebration. I mean, you'd still be only like halfway or so. So maybe they just want to let people at Celebration get a preview of the finale or something. But, you know, leaking it out that early would mean everybody's going to know everything by the time it actually airs. So I really don't know what the thinking was and why, because there's no Marvel series on the horizon either. They're kind of pumping the brakes there. So, who knows why Bob Iger does the things he does, but I think you're right that what we can do as fans is just celebrate Batch and keep shouting out that it's incredible work and it's as compelling as these live action shows. I think, you know, especially last week, I think we all said, like, Batch won. Like, it's not that Mando was bad at all, but Batch was some incredible storytelling. So we'll keep banging the drum and we'll keep eating our breakfast, and hopefully it spreads on that. Hit me up with some of your recommendations, though.
Oh, just one more thing on the Willow front. And I would say this for those of you who are going to Celebration Europe. And this is something going back to the decision to axe Willow. If you run into Warwick Davis, do not say to him, sorry about Willow, because he's going to get that a million times. And that's something that's like, you could have waited until after Celebration to axe that, because it's like, even if he shows up, he's going to feel terrible. And he knows that everybody knows that your series got axed. And I'm like, that's just, you know, that thing could have been announced, you know, that it's not happening at any time. And so I just kind of felt not only bad for it, like I said, it's something where it wasn't necessarily my cup of tea, but I know that there's big Willow fans, old and new, out there. Yeah, they tried something. They probably deserved another shot. But once again, going back to the point, they could have spaced it out somewhere else, because what's going on this summer? I don't know. But at any rate, so, you know, I'm hoping that, like with anything else, the big, you know, the decisions that are coming up and all that, that, you know, someone get a calendar out and start really writing this stuff down. but you're right. Speaking of my recommendations to kind of really take that train around the long way. Once again, I was kind of marking some of these downs. I like making tracks because they're in and out in about 25 minutes. Yeah. And they were focusing on Mando. I did kind of peek my head into RFR, you know, Rebel Force Radio, just to kind of see get the temperature of the Mando, and then hop back out, because it's like a 2-hour episode. I did listen to CWK's, you know, Mando and their Batch One. You know, Mason was back on, and it, you know, great, still doing great over there. Reactions did there. I listened to their Mando episode. What the Force, I want to say, this was like one of the last ones I was listening to. They were doing like a Batch double feature, and I was like, oh, that's cool. I think it was Metamorphosis and The Outpost. And just, it was really kind of interesting listening to that. They always do such a great job. And of course, on the reading side, you know, Jen, who was, like we said, was killing it on her long take, but she also does an abbreviated version that's in Fantatrax. And so if you look at the episode review for Mando, you had Ross in there, our good buddy Ross Holobin. Daniel Lowe had a part of that interview as well as Jen and so forth. So that was nice, because you're seeing, you know, you'll go in there and you'll pick the episode and they have a group. And what's nice, I think it was the first one, like Eric did like kind of an overview and then review, and then everybody kind of picked up a little piece of it. So I really kind of liked how that was kind of laid out. And so if you're, you know, wanting to go through you know, Fanthatrax. I don't know how Mark Newbold does it. They just everything is like written like Mark Newbold, and you're like, wow, you do a lot of writing. Didn't you just launch Substack?
I did. I mean, I gave you the exclusive last week when I launched ioncannon.com, which is now working again. But I had a blog I was working on before my daughter was born, so pre-pandemic. And so I took kind of my favorite posts from that old blog and brought them over, and I wrote up a nice new piece on, now I'm complimenting myself, but I liked it, a piece on Everything Everywhere All at Once, the now Best Picture winning film, which is just an astonishingly fun and goofy and wonderful movie. So yeah, thanks for reminding me. Yeah, people should check it out, ioncannon.com. Take that other Ion Cannon. I got it.
Yeah, they'll have to do Ion Cannon Pod at Substack. I don't know. It's... All right. Yeah, I was experimenting over there, you know, as sort of a, you know, like a resting point for some of the content, but I'll try again tomorrow with sort of a week in review, kind of taking the homestead keeping from the main show and kind of putting it over there. But, you know, it's interesting. Like any new, I would hate to call it a social network, but platform, you really kind of want to kind of play with it for a little bit, and it's fine to kind of write and, you know, just kind of get those, you know, chops back in order. And then that kind of like feeds into the main site that's still working on. But at any rate, all righty. So we are going to start with Bad Batch tonight on the episode Pabu, which was kind of a little warm to my heart because I did live on an island for pretty much the 90s. So, you know, that those kind of events out there, while not, you know, not that dramatic, you know, they were always sort of on your mind. So I would like to let you start off with your first questions on Pabu.
Good. Yes. This is a great episode. So I think I was saying before we started recording, I thought this was a really, really fun episode. I won't give my Pringles cans yet. Uh-huh. But it was self-contained in a lot of ways. So I will say my questions are kind of limited because it was just kind of one big adventure here. And I guess it'll continue next week. We'll see a little bit more, perhaps. But it's not like it really advanced the overall plot. But I have some questions that mix it up a little bit. As we start talking, I just want to give a shout out. I in my note box, I have a little box where I do canon connections, and that was pretty empty this week. But I will say I was listening on my AirPods at like 5:30 in the morning on my iPad to this show, and you could have convinced me it was The Rock being the mayor of the island, very much sounding like he does as Maui in Moana, right? He's the Maui? I think it's Maui, yeah. The kind of demigod in Moana. But it was our friend Steve Bloom from Rebels. Who was Steve Bloom?
Steve Bloom was Lance Crowder. That was the pirate that they you know, they had that deal with. Imari Williams played Shep Hazard. And I have a new segment that we're going to, or a new section of the podcast that we're going to dedicate to director Bennick. We're going to call it Krennics. So when we have little tips and factoids, but the only reason I knew that is because I had to get on, you know, as much as sometimes I don't like to get on IMDb, you know, I get a lot of prep beforehand. In this case, I was curious about, you know, when I saw Steve Bloom, you know, like for the half second they show those credits and there's no way to, like, you have to stop and literally you have to write them down. And that's why I was kind of like, and I thought, like you, I thought, oh, Steve Bloom did. And then I went back and then, now would I have written down the voice of the daughter? Of course, no. And I was like, I was sitting there as I was like rushing through it. But yeah, Steve Bloom did three voices in this. He did Lance Crowder, Mr. Enta, which was on the way down. They meet one of the villagers. I think he mentions my name, and then there is another villager he does the voice of. But if you go back and listen to, and that's the reason of going back in the second time, if you listen to their negotiation, you know, Fee and them, listen to Lance Crowder and you go, oh yeah, Steve Bloom. but you know, to get that, I mean, Aaron Harris had to be, you know, flipping, doing cartwheels because you get Zeb Aurelius's voice from Rebels in there.
But I take the correction and thank you for giving it. But the point stands. How nice to get Steve Bloom back in the mix. And, you know, a lot of the Clone Wars voices come back around frequently, but the Rebels voices don't get those new characters often in that same way, right? We've had Vanessa Marshall return as Hera, but not necessarily these other ones. So, all right, better stick to questions then, because when I try to know stuff, I make mistakes. So here is my first question is, what is Cid going to do to the Batch? She's clearly making threats. What do you think she's going to do?
I was thinking of this, and I have a feeling that, you know, I guess the standard thinking was is that the Empire moves in and puts the muscle on and she's forced to. I do think that it'll come down to some kind of bounty or something that, you know, she hasn't had. You know, she was saying like, hey, I missed out on a few scores. I think something's going to happen that's going to push her to take a score, and she's going to weigh the consequences of and go, you know what, these boys aren't doing it for me. I need the bread, which, you know, I'm like, she goes through money fast, I would say. I mean, this is a, you know, she has, you know, for being a slightly, you know, good business Trandoshan. I mean, anyway, but yeah, I have a feeling that it's going to be a score she either can't with the Empire that she can't, you know, get out of, or they're going to put the screws down. But yeah, I think it's going to be, she's going to hand him over for money. Speaking of the biblical reference, right? You know, the 30 pieces of silver. We are getting near Easter anyway, so.
Yeah. You know, I her threats made it sound like she's ready to just turn him in just out of spite. But I am more in your line of thinking, which is she's too smart for that. She'll save it as a card to play when she needs that card. So like you're saying, if she needs the cash, or if the Empire's closing in on her and she can get, you know, kind of a DJ deal, right? Where it's like, you know, she'll roll over on them to get herself out of trouble. I don't know if the Empire works that way, but if they do, I think Cid will try to keep that card ready to play, not just to punish them for not wanting to work with her anymore.
Yeah, you know, I've often thought, just how much money did DJ walk away from when he was leaving in The Last Jedi? Because that was a big, pretty big trunk. So he, you know, what's he doing right now? didn't you love the Hunter's line, our mutually beneficial arrangement wasn't so beneficial mutually? I'm like, I have that right. It's another one of my krennics, tonight.
Nice wordplay.
I'm looking over these list of questions. Oh, and that's, you did actually take that one. Okay. That one is off the board, Mr. Cass. let's see. All right. Do you think that Fee Genoa was responsible for bringing the inhabitants to, I guess, for lack of a better word, her she-shed stash island?
You know, there's a new comic going on right now, which is Sana Staros, who is a comics character who started in Han Solo started in the main series as Mrs. Han Solo and then went to Dr. Aphra, and now she's got her own series. It's where Pink Milk became canon, which is still so awesome and cool that Justina Ireland did that for them. I would say Fee's relationship here with the island was very reminiscent of what we're seeing with the Sana comic, which Sana didn't have a family fleshed out prior to this comic book. And I think Justina Ireland is bringing her New Orleans influence to actually, I think Justina Ireland is from Baltimore, not New Orleans, but it very much feels like a kind of down home family that has that kind of relationship and pulls together. So anyway, I was getting that kind of vibe off of Fee, that this seems like this is where she's from and this is back home to her, back country or something like that. And I think, you know, it's almost like it's her private, like, this is where I'm going to retire secret. And so I'm going to bridge this over to my question before I throw it back to you, which is, does this just mean we can trust Fee now, right? Like, it seems like we were suspicious of her last time she showed up. And how are we feeling about Fee? Is this really her just demonstrating that she cares about the Batch and wants them to be happy?
And that cleared another question of mine off the board. because, yeah, I had something like, what do you think of Fee's motivations for bringing him here? You know, certainly they make powerful allies. And, you know, it's like, you know, you almost saw a bit of a competition between her and Cid, although I would say, you know, Fee has much better digs than Cid does. You know, and also you have to give it out to, you know, whatever that IKEA is on that planet. I mean, you had to love Fee's, like, you know, little collection chamber. I'm like, can we just as collectors go in and just see what she's got and how she organizes and sorts? Oh, wait a minute. That's another thing entirely. But yeah, you really saw a different side of Fee here, and it's hard not to be a little hesitant, because even Hunter says, why bring us? And she says, makes you wonder. And I'm like, yeah, I'm wondering. but, you know, it's clear that she feels a lot for these people. And so, you know, maybe unlike Sid, and you hate to say it's more of a human Trandoshan thing, but in this case, I do think that there's more of a backstory. These could be fellow, civilians or people who were in her community, or at least on her planet or whatnot. You know, you think of Onderon in a certain way, where it's like, you know, hey, if your planet was, kind of really ripped up during the Clone Wars or whatnot, that maybe you found a place that no one's off the charts, and you can have people there. So, I think it serves a lot of her purposes, but I don't think she certainly doesn't owe Sid anything. So she's clear that it's like, hey, if they don't want to work for her, they can work for me.
Yeah, that's a good point, certainly. And, you know, the only other thing I'm theorizing, speculating irresponsibly in a responsible manner, is there does seem to be a particular connection between Fee and Omega. And I wonder if Fee sees her story. Obviously, we don't have any of her backstory other than when she waltzed in the season premiere. So, you know, wondering if, you know, she sees herself in a young girl who's kind of lost and wants Omega to have a better life. I mean, that seems to be the genuine offer here, is come stay here, let her be friends with kids her own age. I mean, she's got that great Wanda Sykes joke of, like, people who don't share her genetic code, or however she phrased it, really made me chuckle. So, yeah, I think maybe there's just this genuine love of Omega and wanting her to have a better life than she seems destined for at the moment.
Exactly. That's going to be a great segue into my question. Mm-hmm. You know, the beginning, you know, were you surprised that during the altercation with whatever gang it was, that Omega was shown shooting one of the gang? And that's not stun, or maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Intentionally showing the fact that she hadn't been with people her age. You know, they keep bringing it up, like you just said. You know, and they're saying, you know, hey, she's got really skills at fighting. I was kind of taken aback at that, you know, because they clearly, you know, like, we've seen them intentionally use stun and not this one. I don't know whether those arrows were set to kill or not. I don't know what strength her bow is, but, you know, surely she wasn't holding back any. She was, you know, she was sent out and it kind of, like, you could say halfway defense, halfway in, you know, whatever. But I was kind of curious of your thoughts on that encounter as it pairs into what you were just discussing.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm cribbing from Jen's Long Take blog, but one of the early episodes this season, she compared Omega's story to what Tony Gilroy said about Cassian season one, which was, it was the education of Cassian. And I think this season has continued to be the education of Omega. And what you're pointing towards is, you know, Fee seems to be ringing the warning bell, like, hey, like, this has gone on too far, and it's pushing her to a place you might not recover from, right? If she gets too used to that violence and too used to this unsettled life. And, you know, I think there's lots of little strands I'd pull into that. You know, when they lost the ship and she's like, that was our home, and she saw the way everybody was like, yeah, so, like, doesn't matter, it's just a ship. And I think that's all kind of turning her very cold. And that's not who Omega is naturally. And I think Fee does see that. And the suggestion for her to meet kids ends up being right. As soon as she meets another kid, she's like, oh, awesome. And, you know, we saw her meet Hera last season, and she's had some engagement with different kids along the way. And it's like, yeah, this is who you're supposed to be, and what you're supposed to be like at this age. So, yeah, I think you're right. And I think there is real danger here. Now, where is this leading to, like, a crisis at the end of the season? I really don't know. We're also almost out of episodes that other people have seen first. So, you know, there's something really good around the corner. So it'd be interesting to see what happens with her. Let me bridge that into my question before throwing it back to you. We're just going to keep them flowing tonight. This is related to the idea that they could maybe stay in this place, which, you know, seems to be like the cop saying, oh, my pension kicks in 2 weeks. But my question is, what kind of life is possible for Omega? And I think it is related to what you just asked, which is, you know, how can she just get lost in this galaxy? Is it possible for her to not be at the center of this story anymore and get away from all that life? Or is she destined to, you know, be a part of the larger story?
Well, you could have gone back if you went, what, to episode 1 or 2, when that clone that had, you know, the deserted clone, and I forget what his name was.
Yeah, I know the one you mean, but I don't know his name either. The one who married the Twi'lek and they did
exactly.
The chain codes. Yes,
and,
yes, yes.
You know, she could have very easily been with them and had a nice life, you know, anonymously. I do think that, you know, if we've seen Filoni and Ahsoka, Omega has a big spot in this universe and a big story to tell. She's got all the right genetics for it. And I do think that what we've mentioned before about her being introduced to so many different, you know, people and put in positions that I, you know, at this point, if she was going to be sent somewhere, she would have been sent already. And we've seen, you know, there's a danger for her getting a little too comfortable with, you know, with the, being the crew and doing that, you know, when clearly she does need to be involved with more, you know, like, although I love text, like, we weren't, look, you know, look how we turned out. I think that, you know, it's almost like, to me, the education of Hunter and the Batch more than anything else about, look, you know, how are you going to care about the rebellion without learning to care about, like, it's almost like learning, if you can care about and take care of Omega, that's really kind of, to me, the blueprint of how do you want to stay and take care of other people? Because clearly now, you know, when you saw Hunter and you go, that's coming out of Hunter's mouth, you know, like, Echo probably would have been like, you know, like, see, I've been saying this all along. So, you know, it's fascinating, but yeah.
Well, and just to your point, a lot of long lingering shots of Hunter thinking. And I think if we went back and watched the last 2 or 3, I bet there's a lot of those. But they stood out this time kind of before the action hit. And it was really notable, I would say.
I think the only thing I've got really left, because that kind of did trope on another one. And just because we can kind of, you know, finish this off. Is Pabu a rebellion starter pack for the Bad Batch?
Gosh, you know, my fear is that they are going to bring the Empire there, because it feels like almost that kind of story, right? We found an idyllic place away from the fights of the galaxy, and what if we accidentally brought them there? You know, it's not like, I mean, obviously we're skipping around the main events of this episode. I think just because they're kind of self-contained and there's not a lot to ask about them, but they were great. And the tension was there, and the suspense, and the climbing the ladder, and the water rushing out, and all of it was just so well done. But it does really make me think that, you know, if they have this fantasy that they can stay there, you know, look at what the Empire did when to the village that saw the Zillow Beast. It was just mass, you know, extinction for them all, or, you know, murder. So I am worried. So I think it's less that Pabu will be a bunch of rebellion than more that they might get crushed under the boot of the Empire. And I'm not going to be happy if I'm right, but I think that's more the direction this could go.
Yeah, I would love to see Pabu stay just the way it is and then leaving. And then, you know, you can have everything go into turmoil later. But I do think it probably ends up that, you know, Sid pulls them off or something like that. Because I think even Fee would probably push them off a cliff rather than having, you know, for the greater good of Pabu in that case. And, you know, it's, of course, you know, hey, we want to take care of Fee's collection. That's what we really care about. You know, it's like, it's the villagers, yes, of course. Lower Pabu and Fee's collection.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, lastly, I would say that living on an island, having a tsunami warning system, yes, that's a thing. And yeah. I have heard it happen. I've heard it myself. And, you know, when people would have to, you know, not at the rate it was happening, that was that's not exactly how it happens. But as far as, like, people going for high ground, yes. There was even a major earthquake that happened in Guam the first year I was there that was felt up even on the island I was. And I was, I think it was the same night I was in, like, yeah, we'd had a tropical storm that went through and it wasn't that bad. And I was sitting there watching, you know, TV on the couch going, ah, survival, that wasn't so bad. And all of a sudden everything started moving. And this was like a 7.1, 8.1. It was a bad earthquake.
Wow.
Messed a bit of Guam up. And, you know, like my sister was working in the hospital. And it was like things were coming off the shelves and so forth like that. And you're going, yeah. And that's usually the thing. But thankfully, never a tsunami, although lots of alerts. But, yeah, I can kind of sympathize with them going, yeah, that's, you know, just know where the high ground is, folks. Just know where the high ground. If only Anakin would have known where the high ground was. There's your Clone War.
And just to put in a plug, did you see Nerd Matters, one of you and I share our love of his creators. He's putting together his creations. He's putting together a bunch of swag for Celebration Europe, and he has the London Underground logo, but it says Higher Ground. I'm like, I need one of those so bad. I'm not going to Celebration, but I'm hoping he puts the extras up. You know, he's usually pretty good about saving a little back and putting them up on his website. So,
dude, that London bus pin that's in the shape of the AT-AT is tight. Now, I had done an underground, like a Rebel Base Card underground logo after my trip to London last year, and I've been kind of sitting on it going, man, would I like to try to figure out how to work that in there. But oh yeah, Nerd Matters, you know, Nerd Matters, Left Coast Graphics, all those folks. Is it Punch It Chewy Express? I think if they're still doing stuff, a lot of great one. And I know that, I think, Something Special by Kara. That's the, you know, like the fanzine.
Yep. Yeah. Kara does, Kara fantastic DJ work.
She, I think is going to Europe, I believe.
She is, and she has all the Blast Points exclusives are being given to her because they're not going. So you can get a Gorin Shard sticker and some other things. But we were swapping compliments with Kara on Instagram this week. If people don't know her work, you know, I think the zine aesthetic is not for everybody. But if you like the zine aesthetic, Kara nails it. And Director Bennett gave me a piece of her art, Kenobi, over on the shelf a good number of years ago now, but I love it, and I love what she does, so it's a lot of fun.
I'll put the link in the show notes because I had her on the podcast a while ago, and I remember meeting her at Anaheim for the first time. She just does such a great job. It's Into a Larger World by Kara. She is on Instagram, and that is the Instagram handle. It's fun. She has her own community, and she'll like take submissions and put it in there. And yeah, it's certainly a style. I like it. But it's fun, and it's just, like I said, one of those great things out in the community, and it's so fun. But yeah, all that Celebration swag. I mean, hey, congratulations. Dan Zare just announced he's going to Celebrations Europe as well. So I'm like, I'm almost like saying to somebody, it's like, somebody bring me back a pin.
I was thinking, I wasn't upset when they announced the celebrity guest. I wasn't upset when they announced the Pales. But now when I'm seeing everybody putting their swag up, I'm like, oh, can I get to London? My new passport did just arrive. No, I don't think I can.
the Celebration badge art came out. And what I'm hoping is eventually that the store opens up for non-ticket holders, because I did get, for the 2020, I did end up buying the lanyard and the pin just to have it, you know, sequential. So I have Chicago, Anaheim 2020, and then 2022. I'd love to get a lanyard and pin for Europe, just to add to the collection. Like, I think the mirror that all these things are, it's going to come down crashing one of these days. There's so much weight under it. But yeah, I'm kind of hoping for, but it's fun to see the swag, and those are the fun things. Like when all this stuff gets shut down, that's when, all right, that, you know, show me the door. Cause I just think there's so much creativity out in the community there anyway. All right. Yeah. I think we're to our point in this where we could start talking about some Pringles cans rating.
Indeed. I'm going pretty high. I really had a fun time with this one. And again, Bad Batch is beautiful because it doesn't have to be deep. It just can be a lot of fun. So I'm going a full 9 on this for the quality of the animation and the fun of the story.
I'm going to have to agree with you. I'm going to go with a 9 as well. I like, you know, I like seeing a little more of Fee. I like seeing that there's happy places out in this universe. And especially when we're going to talk about Mando, about how, like, whoa, you get some things reset as far as your feelings on certain governments and things like that. I'm going to say this is going to be Pabu's going to be my happy place for a while in this universe. Let's really hope. So I'm going to say 9 Pringles cans on that one. Alrighty. We're going to move on to The Convert.
You're saying we're going to convert this show from a Bad Batch show to a Mando show, are you?
He's not the best co-host in the business for nothing, folks. All right. Hit me with your best shot there.
All right. I mean, I've got to spend an extra minute here on my canon connections on this one. Man, there was good stuff here. So obviously, if you heard the squeal of glee, I think from somewhere over the Atlantic, it had to be Frank who wisely invested, I believe, in a photo op and autograph from Dr. Pershing. Mm-hmm. But nice to see Dr. Pershing back. Big canon connections, starting with the Opera House from Attack of the Clones. You know, I think they're using some of those same plates even. The stairwell is where George has his cameo in Attack of the Clones, so it was great to see. When they're out in the open-air fair, that is pulled from a very old piece of Macquarie art that was done of Coruscant for that opening draft, I think, of Return of the Jedi, where instead of a second Death Star, it was thought they may be going to Coruscant. But Macquarie came up with the idea for those kind of tents, that kind of World's Fair kind of atmosphere, and the idea for the exposed mountain, which I forgot to write the name down of. I did.
I think it's Umate, U-M-A-T-E, Umate Peak.
Yes, and that was, again, a Macquarie idea, and I think we've seen that previously in something animated.
I was going to ask you, wasn't that in Light of the Jedi, didn't the Supreme Chancellor have like a meeting or an op in front of there? Because I was going to be like, hey, wait a minute, you know, my High Republic reading is really low, but I do remember them talking about that, because it's like, you know, in the mind, what the great thing that your mind does with it, it's like, wow, here's the top of the highest peak in Coruscant.
Yeah,
and that's all you can see, you know.
I think you're dead on. So I think that is correct. So Chancellor Lena So with her lions, they're not lions, but the creatures, does have a press conference or something there.
Okay.
And I don't think Coruscant is completely covered in High Republic times, or it's approaching it or something. But yes, they do reference that. So dead on. Good one. We get a nice, and this is just beautifully done, in that scene, there is a song playing, and it is an in-universe version of the Resistance March from the sequel trilogy. Very much like Rebels and Solo gave us the major key version of the Imperial March, which is supposed to be like how the Empire represents themselves in the universe. You know, it plays over the recruitment station in Solo if people are looking for a place to isolate it. But this then is that being turned on its head and saying like, well, now March of the Resistance is the March of the New Republic. Like, that's the anthem of the New Republic, which is super, super cool. My last one is, if people liked this episode and liked the idea of playing around in New Republic politics and liked the idea of looking at what we do with Imperials after this, you have to read the Alphabet Squadron trilogy. I think a lot of people wrote this off because, admittedly, the name is a little goofy. I'm sorry, it just is. But these were three really brilliant books, some of my favorites in the new canon. And the main character is a former Imperial, and it's her kind of being brought over to the Rebellion and dealing with these ideas of what do you do for these people and how do you do it, what's fair. And the climax of that trilogy ends up involving kind of a set of records that the Empire keeps of all their officers and exactly what deeds they did. And the New Republic wants to grab it to punish everybody, and the squadron has to decide if they're going to help or slow that down. And but within that, Yurika Quell, who's the main character, she has a therapy droid, which is very much exactly what we saw in this episode. So you know, the text I exchanged with Director Bennick about this was, this episode to me was that the writers saw some of those early cuts of Andor episodes and they were like, oh, Star Wars can be that? Like, we got to step it up. And I think this was Mando doing its best Andor in a lot of ways. But some great canon connections. Now I'm on a high. I'm going to turn around and grab Alphabet Squadron and start reading while you talk. But go ahead.
Well, and this is...
happen.
No, I was going to say this is also a good place to add the, you know, when he is listening to, and I would ask, was this the first time we'd heard his first name, Penn Pershing?
As far as I knew, I didn't know that before. Yeah.
Because also we have communications officer Katie O'Brien's character, Elia Kane. And I want to say it's probably the first time we've heard her first name. I wrote those down, but not their weird, we've given you a number but taken away your name. I've got a lot more to say on the New Republic in a minute, but I'm going to save it for a little bit. And then the last one, I thought the really cool word of the day, and I'm probably going to blow this, but I think it's ecumenopolis when you're talking about city planets. And I was like, ooh, and that's why I couldn't wait. I wrote it down very early in my notes because I was like, oh, Greg's going to have something to say about that going other city planets? ?
Yeah. I mean, I think Hosnian Prime, but I'm not even positive on that. But
well, not anymore. You know,
well, true. And in Legends, I would have thought about Nar Shaddaa. I don't know if it was ever established that that was entirely a city, but anytime you visited that planet, it was a tall, multi-layer city, very much like Coruscant. So, which would be the Smuggler's Moon, I believe. So,
and I was just going to say when you were talking about that, you know, like the thing they took from the Macquarie Art, like that plaza or whatever. And I'm wondering, didn't they call that before it was Coruscant? Wasn't it called Imperial City or something like that? Very early Legends material.
Imperial Center sometimes, I think. Or maybe that's not even it either. But it did have a name like Imperial Blank, and yeah. It was also had Abaddon in a lot of early drafts, which I have no idea. I don't think that's been used again since, but that was potentially where the final duel was going to take place.
And that has been in more than one trading card. You know, because we've seen a lot of Macquarie Art in trading cards. That one as well. And that was just really great to see because that's the first one you're doing like the Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, GIF where it's like, hey. It was really fun to see all that. A lot more Coruscant than we have. And I think that really, I mean, you know, Carl from Wampa's Lair must just be doing cartwheels. You know, him and all the prequel kids. just really, really great. All right.
I exchanged some messages with him as well. And he's like, we're getting fed again. And you know, Kenobi gave them a lot. And then Andor really respected the prequels. So I think it's clear we've moved away from the J.J. Abrams, what those movies exist. I'm not going to pay attention to them. And we're now at the place where all of Star Wars is really going to get embraced and given its full due. So it's nice. You know, I'm not a prequel guy, but it's nice to see those fans get the respect they deserve.
Excellent, excellent. All righty. Let's fire away
with
those questions.
I believe you asked for a question. I am disappointed because I had written down Elia Kang, and since Katie O'Brien was in Quantumania as well, I thought we maybe had finally sniffed out a crossover, but you're taking that away from me. It is Kane. You were correct again. You're having a good canon night tonight. So
got lucky on the notes this week. That's all.
I have some big questions. I have some little questions. I'm going to roughly start chronologically. Who sent the TIE interceptors? Who's controlling that much Imperial firepower?
This is one also, speaking of Katie O'Brien's character, as soon as we saw her, and I want to say, I can't remember, I'm not going to pin it on her Instagram, but I thought there was another Instagram or something that showed her. And unfortunately, as soon as you saw her, well, that's Moff Gideon. And so for me, who can wield that much Imperial power? Still, it's got to be Moff Gideon. I just, you know, especially going after Castle Crees. This is not just a random encounter. Yeah, she's pissed off a lot of warlords, but no, this was intentional. Now, I think they probably intended her to still be there, but they wouldn't have suspected that. However, that didn't stop the bombing run. But for me, it's got to be Gideon.
And, well, I'll just agree with you and say probably going to reclaim his Star Destroyer, right? Yep. His launch ship.
Stolen fleet.
He doesn't know that the Mandos have run off with it, right? So could it be that he was fully expecting to take back over? So Yeah, I just want to note that's a lot of TIE interceptors, and those are the expensive ones, right? I mean, we see the bombers as well, but the whole kind of canon explanation, they mentioned this a little bit, is TIE fighters, the classic model, were cheap and expendable. No shields, no hyperdrive. Interceptors have shields, which people know if they've played Star Wars video games over the years. You always want the interceptor. They're faster, right? And the interceptor is paired up with the A-wing in most video games because those are similar ships as opposed to the TIE fighter X-wing. So, you know, I'm also, I just, you know, we got to speculate irresponsibly. Remember that Thrawn was very interested in the TIE defenders at the end of his stay in Rebels, right? So these were not the defenders. These were interceptors. But he was more interested in fancier TIEs. And maybe his work towards the defenders started to spin off the interceptor. I don't think any of that has been settled. But we know he's out there. Ahsoka's hunting him. And we are getting some hints that we're going to see him. So maybe it could also be. Mm. And maybe they're not separate, right? Maybe they're working together. Maybe Gideon reports to Thrawn or some such.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, do Moffs report to admirals or grand admirals or vice versa? I would say at this point with Moffs, with some of Gideon's forces being peeled off, that Thrawn would probably have more power and probably be a little, you know, even more subtle and clever with it than Gideon was. And Gideon is pretty smart, considering how the Republic could recover. I'm not going to go there.
Whoa. So that's actually a really good question. And the only data point I have is Wolf Yularen from Rebels and now Andor is an admiral and he's sitting. He's a colonel. He is sitting at the council on the Death Star, which clearly is being run by Grand Moff Tarkin. So would Grand Moff be over Colonel, but would then Grand Admiral be over?
Wait a minute. It's Moff Gideon. It's not Grand Moff Gideon, right? No, it's just Moff Gideon.
It is Moff Gideon. And Moff has usually worked like governor, but of a sector, not a planet.
Right.
But, you know, and Carl was just asking questions on Instagram this week about Admiral Piet's rank patterns, which don't stay consistent at all. So, you know, I think it is a fool's errand to try to do what we were just trying to do. But it is still a really interesting question about who would outrank who. And maybe it's just whoever has the power and the resources at a given moment. So,
yeah, as much as I want to say like Gideon would be the obvious choice and the baddie for this series, and you know, he's too good not to have, you know, Giancarlo Esposito is too good not to have on the screen. If you're paying for his time, get the man on the screen. Boy, would Thrawn really throw, wow, would it really bring it in there? And yeah, at some point, you're going to have to see the blue guy. That's what everybody's kind of waiting for. But if they're working in concert together or one's working for the other, whoo, buddy.
Sounds like some kind of order they might be building, something like maybe a second or no, maybe a first order that they could be working to build out in the unknown regions, which is where Thrawn is. So we'll have to see. I think they know what they're doing. Like we said a couple episodes ago, they're in control.
Thank you. And I'll just insert that here because that was something else that, you know, when my mind wanders and you start thinking like at some point when you think about the First Order troops, right, being kind of not grown, but at least, you know, groomed at a very young age, a la, you know, the Jedi, they're going to have to start being born around this time because we're kind of getting past, you know, Return of the Jedi. Although, you know, it's 6 or 7 years and we know there's about, what, 30 years between, you know, the Return of the Jedi and the Force Awakens. But yeah, at some point you're gonna start having to have First Order stormtroopers being groomed or, you know, bred or whatnot in the, you know, and then
kidnapped
or whatnot. But you're also going to have an infrastructure already in place to realize, hey, why don't we just grow them? So yeah, I mean, it'd be amazing. And what a comeback for the Force Awakens if you saw some semblances of how the First Order is being put together, which it could be that we're moving that way because, you know, we've already had the Ages of the Warlords, but if they start working together, Thrawn and Gideon, towards that, boy, wouldn't your mind just go, you know, at any rate.
Okay, one more irresponsible speculation. Just,
let's do it. We've already gone too far in this episode, so let's.
I accidentally live tweeted my trip to Target yesterday. Although I'm not on Twitter, so I live Instagrammed my trip to Target. There's a new Thai bomber set out, which is really nice, and for some reason has a minifig of Admiral Sloan, who's only been in books and comics.
Oh, that's right.
And it doesn't make sense to me why you would put out a brand new, beautiful TIE bomber set and throw in a character who has never flown a TIE bomber, to my knowledge, or, you know, has commanded them. But last we saw her, she left the Battle of Jakku on the orders of Palpatine and some of the warlords to go build the First Order. So, again, this is a show that really loves all canon. They've respected the Aftermath books by bringing in Cobb Vanth and making sure his story matched what we saw in those books. I think it's highly likely that she's another piece out there in the mix, and we could see all of them forming the First Order.
Lego, Lego, you magnificent spoiler bastards, you. No, that, you know, like I said, I think there's some fun, and I really want to see, you know, you really want to see that Mando 2.5, you know, those episodes, you want to see him vindicated. And I want to see on the back end of this first season, all right, you sped up things almost, you know, costing Boba Fett a little grief. I want to see what you did it for. And, yeah, you know, if you see those hooks, and we already know that there's a season 4, and I would say season 4, probably, if you want to throw out some, you know, more speculation, we can do it so others don't have to. You're probably going to see more of these things where we're getting maybe hints or maybe things that look like, I think you're going to see things that are definitely going to be overlapping at some point, especially if Mando and Thrawn live in the same universe and Ahsoka, all that. Boy, you know, like, we think, like, nah, what really happened during those times? Well, Luke was out there building the temple and all that kind of stuff. Man, some serious stuff was going on. And I'm all here for it. All right.
Don't forget Skeleton Crew, too. That's a big mystery, but we know it's being worked on by Peyton Reed as kind of a part of this Mandoverse moment of Star Wars. So it's set during the same time period. I would doubt it would move everything dramatically, but I think it might be another piece of the puzzle of what they're building towards with a big grand finale where this all comes together, which would be beautiful.
You know, and I'm glad we kind of talked about it, because it's funny, when I looked back at my questions list, there wasn't a whole lot in that first one. I guess it's probably because the events of it moved along. That was probably the big question for that. Mm. So we do kind of, as soon as he says, like, I got a place we want to go, and then you kind of go, all right. And all of a sudden, you know, we show up at Coruscant. And so I'm going to kind of start with my first question.
Mm.
I'll say with a question that I was very surprised that communications officer Kane wasn't killed on the bridge of the light cruiser, because I swear, in looking back at it, I see a dead body there. However, comma, her motivations, it seemed to be pretty clear. You know, is she there to punish Pershing or to get him? I'm kind of like cribbing a couple of my own questions, but I'm trying to figure out what her deal is.
So my read on the communications officer is that she is 100% still an Imperial, and that she has snuck her way into this program in order to clean up loose ends. And if all of a sudden the man who gave his TED talk on genetic modifications winds up at the bottom of a Coruscant cavern dead, that leads to suspicions. But if instead you make it clear that he betrayed the New Republic, and then, oops, he has a medical accident with the Mind Flayer, I think then there are a lot fewer questions. Nobody goes looking into what happened. It's an unfortunate medical incident. And so I think her job was just to clean up loose ends, right? She just had to make sure that nobody can follow the trail of Pershing to the genetic operations to I still think we're going back to Mount Tantus. I think that is going to be the connection to Bad Batch, but that is speculating. But I think, you know, I think it's probably Gideon, but whoever's pulling the strings over Kane doesn't want Pershing's research found out and doesn't want anybody pulling at that string. So she had to take the lighter and burn off the thread.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, it probably would have been very easy to push him off of the train or what, the space train. That would have taken care of it really easy, and it would have been a long time before he was found. But yeah, it was kind of interesting also when she said that she trained at the academy. And I was kind of like, as sort of like an answer with a question, I'm going to have a mini question. Do you think she was ISB like Gideon?
I think it would make sense. It is notable that she was just a communications officer, which doesn't seem like she'd be cut out for this style of field work. So maybe if she had some ISB training, that would make complete sense to me. You know, you just invoked Finn, and by implication, you know, the kids of the First Order, and we still don't know too much about what we know at the time of Bad Batch. The Empire is just starting up the Stormtrooper program and recruiting. Is somebody like her a recruit? Is she forced into the Academy? Is the Academy her only way off her home planet? And so she does it for the opportunity. There's a lot of questions there, but seeing as she does seem to be still completely loyal to the Empire, I think a spy makes sense, because this was very, very savvy. And if you think of the layers it would take to fake your rehabilitation to be in one of these, not just in one of the camps, but then transferred to the housing on Coruscant, I think she's got a lot of skills there. And it's great. This feels like a promotion for Katie O'Brien, the actress, and that's great. She's been so much fun to have in the community, and I'm excited to see more of her.
Yeah, she definitely had a whole lot, you know, like a bigger role. And, you know, yes, and some of her work has really shown, yeah, she's got the chops. And let's get a little more of that. And I'm going to sneak in this one, if you don't mind. That was kind of like my load up, just because it kind of satisfies a little bit of a rant. How is the New Republic better than the Empire again? Question mark.
Oh, I mean, again, I want to give the writers credit. There's a lot of canon that's being flexed here. The nobles outside the opera house are awful in a way they're supposed to be awful, right? It very much reminded me of Last Jedi and Rian Johnson's theme of, you know, those with the money and the power, they just keep gaining money and power during these conflicts. And I think those are the exact types who are outside that that opera house at that particular moment. So it's smaller, right? Like the endless cubicles have an end in this iteration. But certainly, I mean, I think you have to imagine that they were directly inspired to make this as parallel as possible to Andor deliberately to show you that, you know, yeah, we thought we nailed it, and we thought the government, if we built it without oppression, we would be better and we would be free. But, you know, you still got to make the trains run on time and so on. One other shout out to that, because it's a related point. They reference the fact that the Alliance fleet has been decommissioned and dismantled. And that is Aftermath book canon, which is that Mon Mothma, after the Battle of Jakku, or maybe that's Bloodlines canon, but it is canon already. It's established that after the war, they dismantle the fleet as a symbol of, we're not going to conduct war anymore, and we won't have Star Destroyers hanging over your planets and cities to threaten you, which is how, somewhere between Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker, the First Order just sweeps through and takes over planet after planet after planet, because there's no fleet. Whatever is left of the fleet is floating over Hosnian, and so when the Starkiller base fires, you do see some remaining Star Cruisers destroyed in the fire there. So maybe you could say, as a pacifist society, they are better. But we certainly are seeing that the day-to-day life of your average galactic citizen was not that much better. Now, but the Empire would have destroyed the rebels. They would have executed anybody who was a rebel. And the New Republic is trying not to do that. They're trying to offer a chance at redemption and rehabilitation, which so fits into our themes this season of can you change your programming, or mm-hmm. are you going to revert to what your programming originally was? So, you know, I don't want to get too political about, you know, real world politics, but I will say in this country, I think there's a way in which the authoritarians who are on that side of things, they just like fall in line and stuff gets done. Whereas the kind of progressive liberal side of the house is so worried about not offending all the members of it, we don't get a lot done, right? And, you know, I think of something like the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was so laudable in so many of its goals, but never could come together and say, here's our leader and here's our demands, because it all had to be small d democratic and get everybody. And I think the New Republic is that reflected from our society, which is like, yeah, what's the line from Hamilton? Where's Mrs. Daffron when I need her? Winning is easy, young man. Governing is harder, I believe, is what Washington says to Hamilton. And that's absolutely correct. Like, yeah, you can win Return of the Jedi, but it's going to take some time to put a government together, and maybe you fail. It also, I'm just ranting now about everything under the sun, so I'll shut up after this, which is, with All Quiet on the Western Front so prominent in the Oscars race, it's a reminder too that the way World War II happens is the faulty piece of World War I, and the ways in which the world governments overly punished Germany mm-hmm. and made a situation so that Hitler could rise again. And I think that's what we're seeing. The New Republic tried to do things right, and in their misses led to the First Order. And that's a real world lesson that's hard to take, but perhaps we should.
I knew the New Republic was in trouble in what, the first season of the Mando, when you saw Matt Lanter in that New Republic trooper outfit, the Admiral Blue with the white boots. And I'm like, man, this government is got it. I was just like, oh my God. And then you see, you know, when you see the bureaucracy and you see like the, like, it's almost like, well, we just took the Imperial, you know, uniform and dyed it blue. And, yeah. and then of course, by giving, you know, like you have L-58 versus an A, it's one of those things. And even Pershing brings into it, it's like, but this equipment's still good, but it's Imperial. And you're like, oh my God, the bureaucracy is horrible. Someone needs to, you know, someone really needs to come in here. And I don't know, but yeah, I really like how that kind of hit home. I love the parallels in Andor. It's sort of like, yeah, you're right, the day-to-day, yeah, you know. And then, you know, even we've got it hinted all along. You know, what did Greef Karga say? It's like, nah, you know, everybody kind of rolls their eyes when they hear about the New Republic.
Yeah, well, and just one other Andor parallel, and maybe this is a way the New Republic is better. There were complaints during Andor that Coruscant didn't look right, and Coruscant looked right for Imperial Coruscant, mm-hmm. right? But we'd never seen Imperial. We'd seen Republic Coruscant, and now we're seeing New Republic. And it looks closer to Republic Coruscant, right? More traffic, more life. There is some good, joyous spaces there, like the fair and all that. So I do think that they want you to connect the two. And they want you to note the differences, that there is a version of freedom here that the Empire had. You know, it's not everybody walking through the brutalist architecture to go to their office that fast. There's a little bit of life here. So I would celebrate that as a difference.
All right. That's crossed a bunch off mine. I like how this is moving along, and I know we're going a little long, but I wanted, what do you got? What do you still have on your plate there, Mr. Gassman?
Well, let me give you the big one. Yes. For me, for my list, which is, who is the convert of the episode title? Because, you know, Mando has this convention, which every title is the blank, and sometimes mm-hmm. that's different names for the same character over time. But it's clearly singular. It's not more than one, but it's called the convert. Who do you think the convert is?
That did take one off mine. But I'm glad we're talking about it because, yeah, on first glance, right, you start with, oh, we're going, you know, like I saying, oh, we're going to go to Coruscant. And, you know, on the second viewing, you see more of that parallel because, you know, is it Pershing? Is it Mando, or is it Bo-Katan? But I would say for my choice is going to be Bo-Katan because, you know, she kept her helmet on just by chance, just because things moved along there. But, you know, it's interesting when you kind of, I guess, see her reaction of after, you know, due to a technicality, she is redeemed. And, you know, it's so fun. It's so great when you go, oh, that's all it took. But, you know, it's interesting to see her back in a, you know, like her community left her, you know, the one that she was like, hey, I've been trying to organize this and we're doing all this. And as soon as I don't have, you know, the dark stick any or the black stick anymore, everybody goes. But here it's like nobody really questioned anything. They didn't care what house she was from. Oh, you're redeemed. No. You kept your helmet on. You're good. And only Mr. you know, Vizsla was not as thrilled. But I think that was probably more. Well, that'll be kind of interesting to see how they kind of connect, if they do, from past Clone Wars. And, you know, kudos to Disney Plus for having that little Mando track that I burned through a lot of last weekend. I love going back through the Clone Wars stuff and getting into some of the Rebels. But yeah, I'm going to go with Bo-Katan because I do think that, luck of the draw. Hey, kid, you got a crew now. Now what are you doing? What do you think?
Yeah. So when Jen was on Coffee with Kenobi, she used the word diaspora as her one word, which was really just an academic flex, which I would never steal. But it's the perfect word for what the Mandalorian people have gone through, right? And we understand in our own history that there are lots of diasporas of, you know, historical significance. Again, the Jewish people having a diaspora out of Israel and into the world. And then, you know, in our own country, we think a lot about the Black diaspora, where, you know, people were taken forcibly from Africa and spread throughout the world. And, you know, the Black Panther movies play a lot with that idea of diaspora. So what that means to me, my version of diaspora, is often that it's a people without a home looking to reestablish a home. And it's a lot of different ways you get to that point of not having a home and trying to find ways to build home and community. This is Bo-Katan's story. All she wanted, you just alluded to this, all she wanted was to build back that community. And I think at one point she thought it was build back Mandalore. And then another time she thought it was going to be build back the Mandalorian people and go take their revenge, and that will unite the people. But you can't build a home on revenge, on military action. It's really just repeating the sins of before. So you have to build a community some other way. And I think, you know, Bo's tragedy, at least as we understand it at the moment, is that she was so close to doing it and Din accidentally grabbed the Darksaber. Here she is again, so close to doing it, and then who stumbles in like a Dormon, and they make fun of him, and she makes fun of him, and she thinks he's full of bull pucky, but he's accidentally found exactly how you build the people again. And I think my question that I added to this is, how long is Bo gonna keep her helmet on? How long is she gonna stay with the armor and all of them? And I'd love to hear your take on that, but I think she is surprised how good that felt to suddenly be welcomed into that group.
Oh, it's perfect. I love the way you said that. I did like the fact that the armorer said, you know, you can leave anytime you wish. And I think that's got some meat on the bone as far as the phrase is. And it could go either way. So, you know, Bo doesn't necessarily feel like she's trapped in this cult place. And I think she's going to probably see... I think there's probably going to be some film spent on watching this community interact with, right? We've kind of gone past the big alligator dude and, you know, they're kind of there, they're safe. And so I think there's going to be a little bit of seeing how this operates and some dialogue and, you know, before she sees like, you know what, hey, this is just as good as anything else. So it's going to be so interesting. But it's also going to play into the power dynamic of, all right, now what? And, you know, I think that, you know, we've still got an uphill battle to see, all right, we know that Mandalore is no longer poisoned. Why are we here, right? We could be doing this on Mandalore and having, you know, or we could be on, you know, Concordia or Kavala or any other place that apparently wasn't touched. now that we found out that, you know, Din Djarin was raised on Concordia. I forgot it had an atmosphere. It wasn't until I went back there. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do. But I do think that the interaction she's going to see is really going to, you know, change. I think she's going to change a little bit. And I'm all for it because you're right. I think this is the story of Bo-Katan. And let's just do this.
don't lose sight of the fact she is listed alongside Pedro Pascal now, right? She's not in the co-starring part of the credits. She's in the main part of the credits. And I had one other thought, and now it's escaping me, so maybe I shouldn't even bother saying that. But oh, there it is. So we have now seen almost everything from the trailer, and I always think trailer speculation is fair game because people have watched the trailers. But one of the things that stands out to me that we haven't seen are the Mandos jumping out of a ship. And that looks like Bo's ship, and it looks like the people of the covert. So to me, I think there's something happening, and I don't know exactly, you know, could that be Navarro? Where are they going? But that's, to me, the biggest thing from the trailer we haven't seen yet. So are the Mandos going to war, and who are they fighting? Are they busting pirates, or are they busting the Empire? It's something that I can't wait to see.
Busting some caps is what they're doing. All right, I can't wait. Yeah, I got nothing to follow that up with as far as that one, other than I just can't wait to watch. You know, it's funny, because that killed quite a lot of what I had left. I've got one, before we get to our Pringles can rating, at least on my end, I've got one question, and this is kind of a callback. So we were trying to figure out last week, how does Din convince everybody that he's been redeemed? Well, he pocketed that little bit of tourist water, and thus, as soon as the armorer put it in there, it triggered like, hey, has the armorer been using the living waters all along to make all the Mando goodies?
That's an interesting question. It reminded me, I know I had this when I traveled to Puerto Rico in high school, that there was a bay where they took you swimming at night, and as you swam, phosphorescent algae kind of reacted to the motion of the water. And I know there are a lot of those in other parts of the world. That's why I say I heard about it in Puerto Rico, but other places have that. And it had that feel like there was something in it, which really made me think about the living waters. Like, is there some kind of algae, some kind of something in the water? But I will say, I don't entirely understand that. I did note it was green, which in Star Wars is like Night Sister Magic color, which I'm not saying that was Night Sister Magic, but it's like there is something supernatural perhaps about it. And what is it in that water? Could it be as simple as the water reacts to Beskar, or, you know, does the water have traces of Beskar in it so that she can sense that when she puts it in? But I thought it would be special, but then she kind of cast it down like it wasn't, which makes me think something closer to your question, which is like, they must have this already or have access to it. But like, I don't know, your homeworld's destroyed. You have a little vial of what you think is magic water. I think you'd be a little more precious with it. You know, save it to dip the armor pieces in, even if it's just ceremonial. But I don't know. It's a really interesting bit of mythology that I haven't quite wrapped my head around. What do you think?
I love that relationship that you mentioned between the water and the Beskar. And I go, there must be some kind of relationship that maybe if you are able to mix in a little bit as you are forging material, maybe it strengthens the bond, maybe it adds something to it. You know, like clearly when you see, you know, I keep thinking back to the season 2 finale where the Death Trooper just keeps mashing Mando's head into the wall going, that's a good helmet. Because otherwise, you know, he'd be a puddle of goo. But I like the fact that there was a little something to it, because it's sort of like, yeah, everybody's going to be like, all right, yeah, sure. But when she puts it in there and it kind of like reacts to, I'm like, okay, that's interesting. And that kind of leads back to, you know, going back to what, even at the beginning, as Mando's waking up, she said it didn't used to be that deep. Seismic activity from the bombing must have opened up. And then, you know, who would have thought, like, did you see anything down there? No, why? Nothing. Okay. That just probably needs to be said, because it's sort of like, really?
So you're saying it's from the bombing, so you're saying it's radiation. It's radioactive water that now is infecting the client. No. Yes, very interesting and very, very cool to think about Yeah, well, I think it's a tidy explanation for why the Mythosaur hasn't been seen and now is perhaps reawakened, and it reminds us of the Zillow Beast and things like that. So great stuff. Like you said, I don't have explanations or questions. I just have enthusiasm to see it.
All right. Do you have a Pringles can rating for this episode as we wrap things up?
All right. Are you sitting comfortably in your chair?
No, this computer chair from, 2005 is as uncomfortable as you can get. So,
all right. Well, hopefully it's sturdy. I'm going to say something controversial, which is this is my favorite Mando episode, period. And there is probably recency bias, but I thought this was so incredibly good for all the canon reasons I talked about, for all the storytelling reasons. You know, it never feels like we give every detail justice, but that's why we're not one of those 3-hour shows. Thank goodness, because we both have things to do. But I'm going to go, I'm going to save just a little room at the top and say this is a 9.5 for me. I really could not believe how much I was enjoying this. I think I'm somebody who likes Star Wars to be thoughtful and challenging and intricate. And I know that's not everybody. Some people love the whiz bang pew pew, but I like a little thought, a little meal. And so I'm going 9.5 Pringles cans because that's a lot of Pringles to eat. That's a meal.
All right. I've been fighting with this one because I think on my first one, I gave the Coruscant, that trip a little short sight on the first one, because I think that, we were so geared up to see where this goes that any distraction would have taken away. And I think the second viewing through was a little better, and you start to see everything they tie through. And yes, you see some of the subtleties. Once again, please space these programs out so we can enjoy them and see them in the big one. But I'm going to say it wasn't necessarily my favorite Mando, but I am going to give, I'm going to give it a solid 8, and not that that's a slight in any way, but I do think that, there have been others that I have enjoyed more, but I would say that there was a lot in this to enjoy. And as much as the half hour ones were very easy to chew through and for us to kind of talk about, we kind of went a little long tonight than we normally go. But I would say that I am all for, the Mando episodes have been very, efficient. This one just had a lot to tell, and you could have very easily seen these broken up into two episodes in another space and time. But I would say that a solid 8, I'm going to reserve it for a little bit, but I love the fact that so many people like yourself have really latched on it. Like you said, just for all those little bits and bobs that make it, and they're really, filling that canvas out. That's what I like about it. Mm-hmm. All righty. So we want to hear from you folks out there. If you have a question on Bad Batch, you can find us on the socials, Twitter, Instagram, Hive, Substack, get in there. And you can find me at Rebel Base Card. Where can they find you, sir?
Upstairs in my house finishing Jedi Fallen Order before the sequel comes out next month. They can, of course, find me primarily on Instagram at IonCannon, EYEONCANON. Thank you so much to our many fans who already found my Substack and threw their support my way. Sam came through right away. Kyle Scully always asks me about the Wheel of Time podcast, which just warms my heart. So I really do appreciate our community and everybody who follows along and finds me places. So IonCannon.com leads to my blog, and I'm going to try to write. My goal is like once a month, try to write something fun. And I don't do the review thing. What I do is kind of look at larger cultural pictures around pieces of work. And I have a few old ones. I have a really interesting one I wrote about Last Jedi, like the week after I saw it, which is really cool to kind of look at in hindsight and things like that. So check me out over there. And I appreciate you having me on as always, Greg.
Well, no problem. And by the way, it's like, if you think once a month is, that's not a lot of content, read his Solo review. I had to chew on that one for quite some time. So, it's a nice long blog, but it's what I like is that, especially like, you know, there's when we talk with like yourself or Jen or Colby or any of these folks, but when you really have the time and go, you know what, here's my fleshed out ideas. You know, you're holding back when you're on here. And it's really kind of fun to see some real thoughts and you're able to go in and dive in it like that. And, you know, like Grief Cardio says, I celebrate your success. But I hope people get to, and I always put a link to the, Wheel of Time in the description of it, and it'll be in the show notes. All right, we're going to be back next week because we have episode 14 of The Bad Batch. That's Tipping Point, and then chapter 20 of Mando. Is that, if I'm looking at that right?
I think that's right.
All right. We would like, no, we don't really want this to go any longer tonight. We have things to go to, and, you know, a lot of folks have a lot of great content to put out, so we've got to get to it. It's almost like you got to start right after we get done. Right after I post is when I have to start listening to the podcast. So we're going to sign off now, and we're going to return you to your podcast playlist already in progress. This podcast is not affiliated in any way with Topps, Disney, or Star Wars, nor is it endorsed by Disney or Lucasfilm, and is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. All names and sounds and any other related items are properties of their respective trademarks and/or copyright holders here in the U.S. and abroad. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com.